This episode features discussion of kidnapping, violence, and child sexual assault that some people may find offensive. Listener discretion is strongly advised, especially for children under 13.
It had been a good day for Stephen Stainer. His kidnapper, Kenneth Parnell, had been gone all morning, and 7-year-old Stephen had been able to spend a pleasant day reading comic books with the nice man he knew as Uncle Murph.
Suddenly, the cabin door swung open. In walked Parnell, a puppy in his arms.
Stephen loved dogs. He was thrilled when Parnell presented him with a puppy as his very own.
Parnell sat down, pulling the boy onto his lap. He had something important to tell Stephen, he said.
The reason he'd been gone all day, he explained, was that he'd been in court. Stephen's parents couldn't afford to take care of him anymore and no longer wanted him. They'd given Parnell full custody, meaning that Parnell was now officially his dad.
Stephen's heart sank, but he believed it, every word. And for the next 7 years, that belief would keep him tethered to Parnell through endless abuse and assault. Parnell may have been cruel to Stephen, but he was the only one willing to take him. This is Hostage, a Parcast original. Every week, we tell the stories behind the most captivating hostage situations and the people inside them.
We'll also cover these psychological tactics used in kidnapping situations and what the human brain does when held captive.
I'm Irma Blanco.
And I'm Carter Roy.
You can listen to all of Parcast's shows on Spotify or anywhere you listen to podcasts. New episodes of Hostage come out every Thursday.
This is our final episode on the kidnapping of Stephen Stainer by Kenneth Parnell from Merced, California on December 4th, 1972.
Last week, we looked at Stephen Stainer and Kenneth Parnell's backgrounds and examined the events immediately surrounding Stephen's kidnapping.
And this week, we'll dig into Stephen's 7 years as Parnell's captive and the psychological struggles he faced as a victim of abuse. We'll look at why, despite relative freedom, he never tried to escape and what finally pushed him over the edge. We'll also track the work done by his parents and the authorities to try to find him over the years. At Parcast, we're grateful for you, our listeners. You allow us to do what we love. Let us know how we're doing. Reach out on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network.
And if you enjoyed today's episode, the best way to help us is to leave a 5-star review wherever you are listening. It really does help. We also now have merchandise. Head to parcast.com/merch for more information. 7-year-old Stephen Stainer didn't think he was doing anything wrong by accepting a ride home from school on a rainy afternoon in early December 1972. But within seconds, he realized that the 41-year-old man driving the car wasn't taking him home.
Stephen spent the next week in Kenneth Parnell's employee housing in Yosemite National Park, where Parnell worked as an overnight bookkeeper at the main lodge. Stephen wasn't allowed out of Parnell's room in the dorms. Parnell would bring him food and force the boy to use a bucket rather than walk down the hall to the bathroom.
At night, he gave the boy sleeping pills before heading out to a shift in the hotel. When Parnell couldn't be in the room, he'd force Murph, the man he coerced into helping with the kidnapping, to keep an eye on Stephen.
Stephen liked Murph. The two of them read comic books together, and Murph would bring the boy treats whenever he could.
In the years following, both Stephen and Murph maintained that Murph never had any idea that Parnell sexually assaulted Stephen, and Murph later claimed that because Stephen never tried to escape, he must have been happy where he was.
Murph was not overly intelligent and probably had no idea that Parnell was sedating Stephen with sleeping pills.
And Stephen, for his part, never thought to ask Murph for help.
On December 11th, 1972, Parnell took Murph and Stephen to his cabin in nearby Cathy's Valley, and then continued on by himself to Bakersfield, 160 miles south, to ask his mother for money. En route, he spotted the missing posters that Stephen's family and local Merced law enforcement had plastered all over town. The posters included Stephen's full name, birth date, and physical description, including his hair color and length.
Parnell's mother had no idea about Stephen, but she almost always gave her son money when he asked for it. On this occasion, she also gave him a puppy from her dog's new litter.
When Parnell returned to the cabin that night, he gifted the dog to his 7-year-old captive. Stephen was overwhelmed with gratitude, thrilled to have a new companion, and named the dog Queenie.
But when Parnell explained that Stephen was now going to be his son and would be called Dennis, Stephen started to cry. Scared and confused, he protested that his family needed him. But Parnell told him they didn't need him or want him, and that they couldn't afford him anymore. Remembering his family's financial troubles from a few years earlier, Stephen believed him.
The next day, Parnell started to make plans. He returned to Yosemite to drop off Murph and to quit his job. Then he and Stephen, or Dennis as he was now known, returned to the cabin in Kathy's Valley, where he cut the boy's hair and dyed it dark brown. In preparation for their new life, he traded in his car just in case someone might recognize his white Buick from the abduction.
And then, 2 weeks into Stephen's captivity and new life as Dennis, Parnell sexually assaulted the 7-year-old for the first time. The scared child had no idea what was going on, but he knew that he didn't like it. He also knew that Parnell didn't care and would hurt him if he fought back.
Shortly thereafter, Parnell found out that his captive's grandfather lived in the neighboring trailer park. Spooked, he put his plans into motion. On December 18, 1972, he, his new son, Dennis, and their dog, Queenie, drove out of Kathy's Valley and headed 200 miles northwest to the quiet city of Santa Rosa in Sonoma County.
During the 2 weeks that Parnell kept Stephen in Yosemite and Kathy's Valley, law enforcement and the Stainer family were scouring Merced County for the boy. All registered sex offenders in the surrounding area were investigated and psychics were consulted. The FBI asked the head of law enforcement at Yosemite National Park for help, although for unknown reasons, the park's rangers weren't very cooperative with the Bureau.
By Christmas, with Parnell and his new son in Santa Rosa, the trail had started to cool. The Stainer family was bereft, but they refused to give up, mailing missing posters to school districts around California. The Merced police continued to investigate and follow leads, but they were starting to lose hope.
According to former research fellow in the FBI Behavioral Science Unit, Brianna Fox, the first 48 hours after a person's disappearance are crucial because witnesses' memories are fresh and information is most likely to be accurate and useful. The trail can go cold after that, making it much harder to find a missing person alive. Criminology professor Michelle Janice adds that child abductors also often murder their victims within hours, making those investigations especially urgent.
Kenneth and Stephen would spend nearly 2.5 years in Santa Rosa. Stephen started a new school in January 1973 after Christmas break. Parnell had coached him on a family backstory that hewed closely to the truth. The boy told people that he was from the Yosemite area, that his parents were separated, and his mom still lived there with his other siblings.
Stephen attended several schools in Santa Rosa, as the two moved regularly between motels and trailer parks around town, while Parnell struggled to hold down work. But none of those schools ever inquired about Stephen's school records from any of the schools Parnell said he'd attended.
In fact, no one in Santa Rosa ever suspected that Kenneth and Stephen were anything other than father and son. Everyone who knew them said they seemed to genuinely care for each other and behaved like a normal family.
In fact, Stephen only rebelled once. In the spring of 1973, having moved schools twice, he was angry and scared. traumatized by regular sexual assault.
And so one night, not long after his 8th birthday, he waited until Parnell was asleep and snuck out of their trailer. He was going to make his way back to Merced and his real family.
But he quickly became disoriented on the Santa Rosa streets and started to panic. The terrified, crying child wandered around until he found his way back to the trailer, with Parnell none the wiser.
Stephen finally realized that he was completely dependent upon Parnell for his survival. As far as he could tell, he had no choice but to settle into his new life and new identity.
Though the 8-year-old had no way of knowing this, Parnell had engineered a set of circumstances that would keep his captive from leaving. According to developmental psychologist Amy J.L. Baker, if the abductor can get his captive entirely under his control, it puts the captive in an almost infantile state of dependency. As a result, the captor becomes a sort of attachment figure upon whom the captive relies for everything in their life.
Especially for child abduction and sexual abuse victims, this kind of psychological manipulation can result in victims not realizing for years that escape is even a viable option.
Additionally, by giving the boy a new name and identity, Kenneth Parnell likely accelerated a form of dissociative disorder in the 8-year-old. According to Dr. Tina J. Walsh, people who are sexually traumatized often psychologically leave their bodies as a coping mechanism, but the long-term effects often include a dissociative disorder, which can create multiple identities within the victim. In this particular case, Stephen Stainer seems to have been able to disappear into the new identity of Dennis Parnell in order to cope with the trauma of the kidnapping and sexual abuse.
Things started to get better that fall when Stephen started 3rd grade. He and Parnell had settled into a good enough life where Parnell would spoil him and buy him anything he wanted. And Stephen made a new friend at school whose family lived nearby, Kenny Mathias. He started to spend lots of time at Kenny's house, and before long, Parnell had become friends with Kenny's parents, Bob and Barbara. The big family hangouts with all Kenny's siblings were bittersweet, as they reminded Stephen of the Stainers' big family.
Stephen was worried about losing that sense of family in November, when Parnell was able to move them out of the trailer and into a house in a different neighborhood. Stephen had his own room, and the yard was big enough for their dog Queenie to run around while he climbed trees. Stephen again had to change schools, but he was fortunately still able to spend lots of time with the Mathias family.
But the good times were short-lived. By March 1974, Parnell had lost his job, and the two were forced to move from motel to motel. To make matters worse, Kenny's dad, Bob, was an increasingly violent alcoholic who had taken to regularly beating up his wife, Barbara. By the spring, Barbara had left her family and moved into the same motel as Parnell and Stephen.
Before long, Parnell and Barbara had developed a flirtation, and Parnell asked her to move in with him, into their motel room with one double bed. Stephen felt weird about the whole thing, considering she was his best friend's mom.
But then, one night, Parnell and Barbara came back drunk to the room where Stephen was watching television. The two adults started to have sex on the bed, ignoring the 9-year-old, until Parnell ordered the boy to join them. A whole new world of terror opened up for Stephen Stainer.
In a moment, Parnell's new love interest creates trouble for Stephen.
And now back to the story.
In the spring of 1974, 32-year-old Kenneth Parnell and 9-year-old Stephen Stainer were living in a motel along with Barbara Mathias, the mother of Stephen's best friend. Parnell and Barbara had started dating, which initially took Parnell's unwanted attention away from Stephen, until one night that spring when Parnell asked him to join in.
Parnell then proceeded to encourage Barbara to assault the 3rd grader, whom she believed to be Parnell's son, while Parnell watched. While Barbara claimed that this was all done at Parnell's urging, she apparently never saw any issue with it.
That summer, in late June 1974, Parnell bought a trailer in a different trailer park, and the three moved in as a family. For the first several months, they all shared one double bed, and according to later testimony, Barbara and Parnell sexually assaulted Stephen together 8 times.
By the fall, though, Parnell had built Stephen his own bed in the trailer, and the boy's home situation started to improve. Parnell didn't assault Stephen anymore, apart from a few times when Barbara wasn't around.
Around the same time, Stephen started to become a bit of a pyromaniac, lighting matches in the fields surrounding Santa Rosa. Having first gotten in trouble with the law as a teenager for the very same thing, Parnell came down hard.
In fact, there's reason to believe that the pyromania both exhibited was instigated by the sexual assault. According to neuroscientist and author R. Douglas Fields, fire-setting behavior is associated with animal cruelty in juveniles. The other statistically significant risk factors being male gender and the victim of sexual abuse.
Shortly thereafter, during Stephen's winter break in December 1974, Parnell tried for the first time to enlist his purported son to help him find another boy to kidnap.
Parnell drove Stephen to a mall parking lot, where he watched one boy for 15 or 20 minutes. Sure that the boy was on his own, Parnell ordered Stephen to go talk to the kid and try to get him to come back to the car.
Uncomfortable with the whole situation, Stephen approached the other boy and asked him an unrelated question. Then he returned to Parnell and said the boy hadn't wanted to come back with him.
But Parnell didn't get upset. Instead, he just insisted they wait around and find another boy. According to Stephen's later testimony, they spent 2 hours in the parking lot, scoping out boys and trying to coerce them into the car.
A few months later, in spring 1975, after Stephen's 10th birthday, Parnell tried again. He had signed Stephen up at the Santa Rosa Boys Club, ostensibly so that he could participate in after-school and weekend activities.
One day, when he and Barbara came to pick Stephen up, Parnell told Barbara to go get a specific boy to come to the car, and Barbara did.
But as he followed her to the car, the boy got nervous and changed his mind. Suddenly, Parnell panicked, shouting at Barbara to get in the car. He quickly drove off with only Stephen and Barbara in the car.
Parnell was spooked, worried someone had noticed and could identify them. And so a few days later, on May 12, 1975, he pulled Stephen out of school and again upended the boy's life. Stephen hit the road with his two sexual abusers, anxiously imagining what new horrors awaited him at their destination.
Kenneth Parnell relocated his makeshift family 80 miles north of Santa Rosa to the town of Willits in Mendocino County.
But when Parnell couldn't find a job, they moved again a month later, this time to Fort Bragg on the Pacific Coast. There, Parnell and Barbara decided to open the Fort Bragg Bible bookstore using money from his mother.
That summer, Stephen started to act out even more. He again got caught playing with matches in the fields and forest of rural Fort Bragg, and again, Parnell lectured and spanked him.
A couple months later, Stephen and a friend were caught shoplifting toys from a store, and the manager called the police. Somehow, the police never figured out that Stephen wasn't actually Parnell's son, and Stephen was too scared of being in trouble to even consider telling them he'd been kidnapped. After all, he still believed his real parents had given Parnell custody.
By next spring, in 1976, the Fort Bragg Bible bookstore was failing, and Barbara's divorce was finalized. Her 4 kids, including Stephen's close friend Kenny, suddenly moved in with them in Fort Bragg. Their trailer wasn't big enough for 7, so Parnell bought an old school bus and converted it into a home for the newly expanded family in the nearby fishing village of Noyo.
Despite the evident stress on Parnell and Barbara's relationship, Stephen was thrilled with his new housemates. His friend Kenny was now practically his brother, and the two 11-year-old boys had free rein to explore the rugged outdoors and coastline around town.
Kenny didn't like the new arrangements quite as much. During the several months they all lived together, Parnell tried to sexually assault Kenny. Unlike Stephen, Kenny fought back and later told Stephen what his father had done. Stephen, embarrassed that the truth about his relationship with Parnell might come out, ignored his friend's story and hoped the situation would go away.
And indeed, it did. In June 1976, Barbara met someone else and moved her family out of Parnell's school bus.
But Stephen's relief at both Barbara's departure and the resolution of Kenny's accusation was short-lived. Almost as soon as Barbara was gone, Parnell began assaulting the now 11-year-old boy again.
Despite the fresh trauma, other parts of his life continued to look up. That summer, Parnell relocated them again. This time, they moved 30 miles south to the tiny rural town of Compche, where he'd gotten a bookkeeping job.
For the first time in several years, Stephen had his own room, and he loved it. The 200-person village was rustic and rural, and Stephen and his dog, Queenie, had hundreds of acres of wilderness to explore. As he and Parnell settled in, they cultivated a vegetable garden and raised animals like chickens and pigs.
By the time Stephen started sixth grade that fall, they'd already been integrated into the small community, and he quickly made lots of friends his age. While he got into a little bit of trouble, smoking both pot and cigarettes, for the most part, Stephen had a semi-happy life in Compche. It was the first time he'd had stability and community since Parnell had kidnapped him from Merced, and if he could compartmentalize, he could almost ignore the still regular assaults from his otherwise doting, quote, father.
Indeed, Stephen was so happy with his life in Compche that the following spring, in 1977, when his sixth grade class took a four-day trip to San Francisco, it never occurred to him to try to run away. He was having too much fun with his friends and enjoying exploring a new place.
In fact, the other parents in the Compche area were surprised by just how permissive a parent Parnell was. Mendocino County was generally considered a bit of a hippie, live-and-let-live area, but even by their standards, Parnell was a relaxed parent. He seemed to let his son do whatever he wanted and go wherever he wanted. As Stephen got a bit older, Parnell even bought the kids cigarettes and beer. When money was good, Parnell was especially generous, buying extravagant gifts for Christmas, including a motorbike.
Stephen's relationship with Parnell had shifted. He still needed Parnell to provide for and take care of him, but he'd also come to appreciate much of the lifestyle that Parnell had given him.
He would later talk about how he wrestled with diametrically opposed feelings, potentially due to a dissociative disorder. He cared about Parnell and felt immensely grateful to his kidnapper for taking care of him and giving him a nice life, but he also hated and feared him.
With Stephen both physically and psychologically dependent upon him, Parnell still continued to look for other boys to control. He tried several times to molest Kenny Mathias when the boy came to visit, and in spring 1979, sexually assaulted Kenny's younger brother, Lloyd. Both Kenny and Lloyd told their mom, Barbara, who called the police. Unfortunately, the police didn't believe her and never followed up.
Parnell continued to use Stephen to try to find other victims. He would regularly tell Stephen to invite specific friends for sleepovers, and then sometimes send Stephen away for the night. In one case, Parnell got Stephen and his friend drunk on beer and then took nude photographs of them. In another case, Parnell took it a step further by ordering Stephen's naked friend into his bedroom. The boy managed to escape before Parnell assaulted him.
When this sort of thing happened, Stephen just hid in the other room, feeling guilty. He later told journalist Mike Eccles, "I just kind of figured that if he was having sex with him, he wouldn't be having sex with me.
On the other hand, he protected his best friend. Damon, Carol, and Stephen met and became instantly inseparable during the summer of 1977, when they were 12 years old. Damon said that while Stephen told him several times that he used to have another family in Merced that he'd been taken from, he never had any idea that Parnell sexually abused Stephen. When he learned about the abuse years later, he realized why Stephen had never left him alone with Parnell.
As Stephen got older, he started to let the long-buried truth about his past slip out. First, in seventh grade, Damon told their teacher that Stephen had been taken from his parents when he was little. The teacher wasn't sure what to believe, as the admission came immediately after the class had discussed an article about missing children.
A year later, in spring 1978, when Stephen was 13, he got drunk and high at a party with some older kids and, according to several of them, started crying and telling everyone he wanted to go home. And he didn't mean to Parnell's. None of the other kids knew what to do, and after the fact, Stephen denied having said anything about it.
Back in Merced, the Stainers would have appreciated any of these tidbits. They had no way of knowing that most of the flyers they diligently mailed out to California school districts had never been distributed. In fact, they'd heard nothing since Stephen had disappeared.
Dell often said that if he just knew his son was dead, then he'd be able to have a funeral and move on. But not knowing tortured him, and he withdrew from his four other children and his wife, leaving Kay to keep the family together and their hope alive.
As Stephen started to get more restless, so did Parnell. By early 1979, Stephen was nearly 14 and becoming a teenager. He was moodier and less easily controlled. He kept getting caught playing with matches and lighting grass on fire. And Parnell was no longer as interested in him sexually.
Parnell still tried to use Stephen to attract other boys, even going so far as to offer to pay one of Stephen's friend's 10-year-old cousins, but it didn't work. And so Parnell decided to make a new plan.
On July 8, 1979, two tourists accidentally discovered the remains of two young teenagers in a Mendocino County forest. Within days, the story was in the local papers and the talk of Mendocino's small communities.
A few days later, without warning, Parnell picked up sticks and moved himself, Stephen, their dog Queenie, and all their farm animals 50 miles south of Compche, to the even more remote Mountain View Ranch. Set along winding roads through rugged coastline, 12 miles from the closest town, the ranch was 4,400 acres of mostly wilderness.
It's worth noting that despite the suspicious timing of the move, DNA testing in 2016 showed the remains to be those of two girls aged 14 and 15. Considering Parnell's history, it seems unlikely that he had anything to do with their disappearance and murder. However, the suspicious nature of the move has led investigators to speculate that Parnell was concerned about the discovery of young teenagers' bodies in Mendocino County.
Either way, their new home, Mountain View Ranch, was owned by a few local brothers who, gossip suggested, had a marijuana operation growing up there and needed someone to guard it. When Parnell had heard about the caretaker's cabin and free living situation, he jumped at the chance.
14-year-old Stephen wasn't so pleased. After three stable, relatively happy years in Compche, surrounded by his friends and community, he found himself isolated and once again, alone with Parnell in a tiny space. Their comfortable home had been replaced by a cabin with no electricity, and instead of a bathroom, an outhouse.
To make matters even worse, it was almost impossible for Stephen to get to school. Parnell got a new job at the Palace Hotel in Ukiah, 40 miles inland, while Stephen's school, Mendocino High, in the city of Mendocino, was more than 30 miles to the north. That fall, Parnell would drop the freshman off in town on his way to work. From there, the boy hitchhiked to the school bus.
Stephen was set on joining the freshman football team at Mendocino High. He made the starting lineup, and Parnell came to games whenever he could. But after football season, Parnell couldn't be bothered to drive out of his way every day, so Stephen transferred to the closer Point Arena High School.
That didn't solve Stephen's problem, though. The closest place the school bus stopped was 9 miles down the hill from their ranch. 9 miles that a 14-year-old wasn't always inclined to walk in the miserable winter weather that swept along the Mendocino County coastline. Already resentful of having to leave his friends, Stephen played hooky nearly a third of the time.
As Stephen and Parnell's relationship deteriorated, Parnell stepped up his efforts to find another, younger son. He started to bring up the idea of kidnapping a boy from Santa Rosa, but Stephen tried to ignore or rebuff him. So Parnell started to look for a different co-conspirator. And fortunately, Stephen brought one into their home.
In a moment, Parnell enlists the help of Stephen's friend in kidnapping another son.
Now, back to the story.
By late 1979, 14-year-old Stephen had developed an acquaintance with a former classmate named Sean Poorman. Sean was friends with some of Stephen's Comanche friends and was generally considered a bit of a troublemaker. He was a small-time drug dealer who regularly skipped school, got in trouble with the law, and was a bit of a bully and ringleader.
In November 1979, Parnell met Sean for the first time, but the teenager's reputation preceded him. 48-year-old Parnell immediately enlisted teenage Sean to help him sell some pot he had stolen from the ranch. Sean agreed, but thought Parnell was a bit weird and ultimately smoked more than he sold.
But as the two got to know each other, Parnell realized he could control and use the teenager. Before long, he told Sean a similar story to the one he'd told Murph 7 years prior. He admitted to Sean that he'd kidnapped Stephen and said that he now wanted another son. Again, he said he wanted to take a little boy who had a bad family life, perhaps a kid whose parents didn't want him anymore.
Parnell had a whole plan, and he even offered to pay Sean to help him carry it out, right down to buying the sleeping pills they'd give the little boy. Sean strangely didn't seem fazed by the whole thing, but he ultimately took the sleeping pills himself and spent the money Parnell gave him without making any moves to kidnap anyone.
That winter, Parnell got increasingly restless. Frustrated with Sean's lack of action, he also stepped up his efforts to find another kid. He drove Stephen to Santa Rosa to hang out in mall parking lots and scope out possible targets, just as they had in 1975, but nothing panned out.
Simultaneously, Parnell started to rag on Stephen, who was clearly reluctant to help him. He called the sullen teenager useless and worthless, attempting to guilt Stephen after all these years of taking care of him.
By February, though, Parnell had found what he was looking for. He took Sean and Stephen into Ukiah on several reconnaissance trips in order to follow a small, tow-headed 5-year-old boy he'd spotted a few days prior. Sean didn't seem to care much, but Stephen felt himself getting angrier and angrier at the prospect of Parnell kidnapping someone else. But he also felt completely powerless. He was still psychologically and physically dependent upon Parnell and didn't see any way to stop what now seemed inevitable.
As upset as he was, Stephen had no idea that Parnell's plan extended beyond the kidnapping. In his book, I Know My First Name is Stephen, Mike Eccles writes that Parnell had already dug a grave in the Redwood Forests. Once his new victim had been secured, Parnell would murder Stephen and bury him in the middle of nowhere. Then Parnell would take his new son across the country to a cabin in Arkansas he'd purchased, sight unseen, the previous year.
On the afternoon of February 13th, 1980, 48-year-old Kenneth Parnell picked up 14-year-old Sean Poorman at school, leaving his own supposed son, Stephen, to get back to their remote ranch in rural Mendocino County on his own. When Stephen finally got home, Sean and Parnell were drinking whiskey, and Parnell immediately started insulting Stephen for being worthless and unwilling to help his father.
Stephen got upset. He'd been living with Parnell for more than 7 years, and until recently, they'd had a pretty good father-son relationship, despite the fact that Parnell also sexually abused him. Parnell had doted on him and cared about him, but those days seemed to be ending.
At 11 p.m., Parnell headed into the town of Ukiah, an hour away, for his night shift at the Palace Hotel, and he took Sean with him, claiming the two of them had to pick up a box spring from a garage sale the next morning. But they all knew Parnell was planning to kidnap the little boy he'd been surveilling the last couple weeks.
While Parnell worked his shift as the overnight desk clerk, Sean watched movies and slept in the lobby. At 6:30 a.m., Parnell sent the teenager out for coffee and donuts.
At 8 a.m., when his shift ended, he took Sean to McDonald's for breakfast and to finalize their plans. Parnell wanted Sean to get the boy into the car and then give him sleeping pills to be washed down with orange juice. Then, he insisted, Sean had to cover the 5-year-old with a blanket until they got out of town.
At 8:30 a.m. on Valentine's Day, 1980, the two drove by the town's Yokeo Elementary School. But they didn't see the boy they were looking for, so they spent the next few hours at thrift stores picking up new clothes for the kid. They even popped into a pharmacy to pick up more sleeping pills.
By the time the kindergartners got out of school at 11:30 a.m., Parnell and Sean were in position. Parnell drove around as the little kids started to walk home until they saw the blonde 5-year-old they'd been watching, a boy named Timmy White.
When Parnell saw Timmy wave goodbye to a friend and continue on his own, he pulled to a stop just around the corner. Sean got out of the car and pretended to be checking the back tire.
But Timmy was less credulous than Stephen Stainer had been at age 7. When Sean asked Timmy to hold something for him as he fixed the tire, the 5-year-old refused and kept walking. Sean, assuming that was it, gave up.
But Parnell wasn't done. He started shouting and swearing at Sean, telling him to grab the kid. Timmy started to run, but Sean quickly caught up to him and grabbed the boy.
Within seconds, the screaming child was in the back seat of Parnell's car, a blanket over him as they sped out of town. Sean gave Timmy the sleeping pill and juice as ordered, and the boy passed out.
That afternoon, Parnell uncharacteristically went to pick Stephen up at school. When Stephen got in the car, he saw the sleeping 5-year-old in the back seat. He didn't say anything to Parnell the whole way home, although his insides began to fill with anger and dread.
That evening, Parnell doted on Timmy, letting him rest on Stephen's bed and giving him Stephen's toys to play with. He let Timmy complain about the food he served without punishment, and Stephen, despite everything, started to get jealous of the attention the man he considered his father was lavishing on this new boy.
The next day, Parnell dyed and cut Timmy's hair, just as he'd done with Stephen Stainer. He even told Timmy the same lie, that his parents couldn't afford him anymore and didn't want him. He made Timmy sleep with him at night, though Timmy always maintained that Parnell never sexually assaulted him.
For Stephen, the experience was triggering. At times, he felt like Parnell was taunting him, reminding him of his own kidnapping experience. But he also began to realize that Parnell was going to do the exact same thing to Timmy that he'd done to him. Stephen thought that maybe it was too late for him, but he didn't want that tiny 5-year-old to have to endure the same traumatic experience he'd had.
Within days, Stephen started carrying his throwing knife and staying home from school with Timmy, hoping to protect the little boy should Parnell attempt to assault him. He took Timmy with him to explore the ranch, and the two quickly bonded. Stephen told Timmy that Parnell had taken him from his family too, and Timmy, not fully understanding the situation, begged Stephen to take him home.
Perhaps it was the reminders of his own kidnapping and life before Parnell, or perhaps it was jealousy triggered by his psychological attachment to Parnell, but for the first time, Stephen decided to disobey his kidnapper. He agreed to take Timmy home.
Stephen figured the best way to get the little boy home would be at night while Parnell was at work. And so, one night, the two boys set out along the winding mountain roads. But the pouring rain got the better of them before they were able to hitch a ride, and Stephen had to carry the complaining 5-year-old back to the ranch. They tried several nights in a row, but the miserable weather beat them each time.
Finally, on the night of March 1st, 1980, Parnell headed off to work a little early for his first shift at his new job as the overnight security guard at the Palace Hotel in Ukiah. Stephen watched the car disappear down the road. Then, he and Timmy ate a quick dinner of sandwiches and dressed for the cold and windy weather.
The two boys set out into the night. Stephen set a quick pace, hoping to make good time before the cold got the better of them. At least it wasn't raining.
They hadn't been walking for more than half a mile when they spotted headlights behind them. Stephen's heart leapt to his throat, but he reminded himself that it couldn't be Parnell coming from that direction. He stuck his hand out to hail the car.
The car stopped for them, and Stephen realized that the driver only spoke Spanish. But they were able to communicate that they were two brothers heading home to Ukiah. Luckily, it turned out that the driver was heading there too.
Timmy sat on Stephen's lap, terrified, as the car wound along the dark, twisty roads. In the 5-year-old's mind, getting a ride with a stranger meant he might be getting kidnapped again. And his only consolation was that Stephen was there too.
An hour later, they pulled into Ukiah, and Stephen suddenly realized he had no plan. He'd been so focused on getting them here that he didn't know where to go or what to do.
Luckily, Timmy realized they were near his babysitter's house and whispered to Stephen that he wanted to go there, so the driver let them out. But when they got to the house, no one was home. As they started to wander, Timmy realized he had no idea where he was and no idea how to get back to his parents' house.
Stephen decided there was only one other option, the police station. But that required that they walk right past the Palace Hotel where Parnell was working.
Stephen steeled himself. He had his Bowie knife in his boot, though he didn't know if he could use it on the man he considered his father. Their best hope was just to move quickly.
Stephen led Timmy purposefully past the hotel and across the street. And within minutes, just after 11 p.m., they were at the police station parking lot out of sight of the hotel.
After all his years of not going to the police, Stephen still knew what Timmy had to do. He told the 5-year-old to go into the police station and tell the policeman his name. Timmy was scared to leave him, but Stephen promised him that it'd be okay.
Timmy made it all the way to the front door, opened it, and then panicked. He turned and ran back across the parking lot towards Stephen, who was already walking away.
Inside the police station, a patrol officer had seen Timmy come to the door. It was strange enough to see a kid at the station this late at night, but for him to suddenly turn and run away toward another kid was even weirder. He radioed to see if any cars were in the area and could try to intercept the two boys.
A patrol car caught up to Stephen and Timmy within seconds. Stephen told the police officers that the little boy was Timmy White, the missing 5-year-old they'd spent the last 2 weeks in search of.
When the officer asked Stephen who he was, he admitted that he was Stephen Stainer and that he'd been taken from Merced 7 years ago. It felt weird to say his own name aloud, and with it came a huge weight that seemed to lift off Stephen's chest.
The police spent the next few hours trying to get Stephen to tell them who the boy's kidnapper was, but he refused. He may have been able to tell the police the truth about himself, but he was still psychologically dependent upon Parnell. He later explained that he felt grateful to Parnell for having taken care of him for 7 years, and that turning him in felt like a betrayal.
After several hours, the police managed to get Stephen to give them enough information to arrest Parnell at the Palace Hotel before his shift ended. Stephen Stainer's 7-year ordeal was finally over.
Stephen's reintegration into his family wasn't easy, and he found it hard to acclimate to his life back in Merced. After years of being given free rein and being allowed to smoke and drink, he chafed against Del and Kay's strict parenting style. And for their part, Del and Kay barely recognized their sweet and friendly 7-year-old in the moody teenager who had come home.
But the Stainers were so thrilled to have Stephen back that they didn't care. Their unwavering hope that he might still be alive had paid off. Kay cooked all his favorite childhood meals. Del showed him where they hadn't painted over the scribbles he'd done on the side of the garage. And his siblings brought him up to speed on all the family activities from the last 7 years.
In the years to come, Stephen and his parents became advocates for child abduction victims and their families. Stephen also enjoyed advising on a TV movie about his story and hoped that publicizing it might help other kidnapped kids realize that they too could escape.
It also helped to be able to have an outlet to talk to about his experience, which he didn't seem to have anywhere else. As traditional Latter-day Saints, Del and Kay refused to allow Stephen to go to therapy, and Stephen almost never discussed the sexual abuse he experienced. Indeed, it took the police investigators months to get him to even admit that it had happened. And even then, he only admitted it after being presented with the naked photos Parnell had taken of him.
Part of the reason behind that was the victim-blaming culture that was as prevalent then as it had been when Parnell himself had been sexually assaulted in the 1940s. Additionally, homophobia was especially prevalent in the 1970s and 80s, and doubly so in the LDS community. Both Stephen's lawyers and his parents were paranoid about having his sexual assault by an older man mentioned in public out of fear that he would be seen as damaged goods.
For years, Stephen continued to struggle with his feelings toward Parnell. He couldn't reconcile his gratitude with his anger and hatred. He wanted to be able to talk to Parnell in person, but his parents refused.
Unfortunately, Stephen never had the chance to work through his trauma. As soon as he got his driver's license, he started buying fancy cars and then proceeded to wreck them, much in the way that Parnell had done when he stole cars as a teenager. He drank heavily and continued to smoke pot and made a point of sleeping around. He got married in 1985 at age 20 and quickly had 2 kids.
And then in September 1989, Stephen was in a fatal motorcycle accident. He died at the age of 24, barely 10 years after his escape from Parnell. His family has done their best to honor his memory by continuing to speak out for victims of kidnapping and abuse.
It took 17 years, but ultimately, Stephen's kidnapping was the thing that killed him.
Thanks again for tuning in to Hostage. We will be back next Thursday with a new episode.
For more information on the Stephen Stainer kidnapping, we found I Know My First Name is Stephen by Mike Eccles to be a fantastic resource, in addition to the many sources used in the creation of this episode. You can find more episodes of Hostage, as well as all of Parcast's other shows, on Spotify or anywhere else you listen to podcasts.
Several of you have asked how to help us. If you enjoy the show, the best way to help is to leave a 5-star review.
And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. We'll see you next time.
In the meantime, don't take your freedom for granted. Hostage was created by Max Cutler, is a production of Cutler Media, and is part of the Parcast Network. It is produced by Max and Ron Cutler, sound design by Andy Waits, with production assistance by Ron Shapiro and Paul Mahler. Additional production assistance by Maggie Admire and Carly Madden. This episode of Hostage was written by Kate Thorman and stars Irma Blanco and Carter Roy.